And this is KPCW. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Beautiful day here in Park City, but let's see what the weather is going to be coming up this weekend. Here with a report, we have Cedric Haynes with the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Friday forecast across the Wasatch Back. We're looking at lots of sunshine as we go throughout your Friday. And temperatures, well, they're going to remain on the somewhat comfortable side as we go into this afternoon. We're looking at high temperatures today climbing into the lower 80s for us. For Park City for your Friday afternoon, the Heber Valley will see temperatures climbing into the upper 80s to right around 90 degrees. As we go into the weekend, we've got lots of sunshine for you. High pressure rebuilds across the area. So not only is it going to be sunny, it will stay dry, and we're going to see those temperatures starting to warm up as well. So we'll see those temperatures going from the upper 40s and low 50s for your Saturday morning to high temperatures into the mid 80s for Park City for your Saturday afternoon. And the Heber Valley will see those high temperatures climbing into the low to mid 90s across the region. As we go into your Sunday, yeah, it gets even warmer out there with lots of sunshine. Temperatures will climb into the upper 80s to near 90 in Park City, and we'll see those high temperatures in the mid 90s as you get into the Heber Valley. But the temperature warm-up doesn't stop there. We continue to climb as we head into the beginning of next week. That high pressure will strengthen across the region. So Monday, we've got lots of sunshine, high temperatures in the low 90s for us in Park City. And we'll see those temperatures into the mid to upper 90s for highs for the Heber Valley. Heading into your Tuesday, lots of sunshine as it will stick around across the region. High temperatures will be into the mid 80s there for Park City, and will be into the low 90s again for the Heber Valley. And we stay with those temperatures near 90 in Park City as we get towards your Wednesday, and highs into the low to mid 90s for the Heber Valley. We are seeing some hints that we could see a little bit of monsoon moisture try to return to the area. That would not actually occur until about next Thursday or Friday, so quite a ways out. But the chance of maybe seeing a few isolated mountain showers popping up again would be possible then. Until then, it's a dry and hot forecast across the area. That's your latest forecast from the ABC Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Aaron Williams of Basin Rec about recent events at the Willow Creek Dog Park. Then Councilmember Bill Sirocco will stop by with a recap of last night's Park City Council meeting. And we're going to finish our hour by chatting with Ember Conley of Park City Performing Arts about this weekend's kickoff to Concerts on the Slopes. Stay tuned. Local historians will share the story of Union Pacific Railroad's decision to end 108 years of service between Echo and Park City this weekend. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more on the End of the Line lecture at the historic Echo Church.
David Nichols and Stuart Stanek are history buffs and train enthusiasts. Nicholas says mining operated in Park City for 112 years and rail service came into town for 108 of those. He says the lecture will cover Park City's economic changes from the mining days starting in the 1880s to present day, when a very busy rail line was once used to haul supplies in and silver ore out of Park City.
They needed each other to survive, but without a way to get it to the regional and national and global markets, Park City would never have become a boom town. And the fact that the Transcontinental Railroad came through Echo in 1869 was, you know, like a godsend in some ways for the development of the mining industry here. And passenger business was never a big entity here. By the early 1950s, it was essentially over.
A phosphate plant operated near the entrance to Browns Canyon Road between 1965 and 1986, representing 90% of the business on that line. Nicholas says just weeks after the plant closed, Union Pacific announced it intended to abandon the rail line or sell it. That opened an opportunity for what could have been a connection from Echo to Provo.
There were a variety of entities interested in preserving the spur. One of them was a combined effort by Wasatch County, Summit County, and Utah County. It would have been a 67-mile-long short line, mixed use, commuter, tourist, and industry. Unfortunately, they weren't able to raise the funding for that.
Then a handful of Park City residents stepped up, creating what is today's rail trail.
In kind of a panic, there were a group of extraordinary people that came together, and those people had this vision of the importance of preserving the right-of-way and the property associated with it, which was 31 miles and a little over 400 acres. And they combined together to apply to the Federal Rail Bank program. And what was the Park City Spur in 1992 became the first rail trail in Utah's history.
The historic Echo Church is 30 miles from Park City on I-80 near the division of Interstate 84 at exit 169. Built in 1876, the church is open Saturdays during the summer from 11 to 4. This free lecture is Saturday, July 12th at 4 p.m. A second lecture on Wednesday the 16th will focus more on Park City than Echo. It starts at 5 o'clock at the Park City Museum's Education and Collection Center at 2079 Sidewinder Drive. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
While it's yet to appear in the Summit County Sheriff's Incident Report, there have in fact been repeated incidents of disorderly conduct at the Willow Creek Dog Pond by dogs. Here to explain what really is going on is Ranger Supervisor Aaron Williams. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Roger.
So, Aaron, what has been happening at what is commonly known as the Dog Pond in Willow Creek?
Well, if we can touch on that just a little bit, it would be great. The pond itself is not a dedicated dog pond. It's primary.
Tell that to the dogs.
its primary function really is a water retention pond, and that we use that water to irrigate all the fields there at Willow Creek. As a byproduct, you know, in the winter, we get to open it up as the skating rink. During the summer, we can allow dogs in there when it's safe to do so.
Is it actually inside the fence of the dog dog park at Willow Creek?
It has its own fencing, okay. So it is separated from the grassy side of the mm-hmm. dog park. So, you know, touching on that, we do have to close it for safety reasons throughout the year, whether it be thin ice, soft ice, algae blooms during the summer, and, you know, unfortunately, wildlife conflicts.
So tell us about the wildlife conflict that we're dealing with.
So really, I mean, to sum it up, it comes down to behavior. You know, folks, dogs getting out there, going after the ducks, having poor recall on the dogs. The dogs continue to go after them. We even had some people encourage their dogs to go after the ducks, throw toys towards the ducks so the dogs go after them.
That seems kind of vindictive, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's unnecessary.
And back up a second. How many ducks are there, and is it new to have ducks inhabiting the pond in the summer?
So currently we have the mother with four ducklings. It's not uncommon, mm-hmm. But we just haven't had the conflicts in the past like we're having this season. You know, despite putting up signage, despite trying to educate, having the animal control officers come out as well, you know, the problem continued. We had numerous phone calls, emails, you know, plus our own staff's observations of the behavior going on. So we had to make the difficult decision to temporarily close the pond.
And okay, so that's now in place. Any sense of how long that's likely to last?
Really, until it's safe to do so, until it's safe to open.
And is there a legal requirement that you guys have to do this to protect the ducks, or is this just a judgment that it's the right thing to do?
This is a judgment call on this side.
Okay. Anything like this happened before that you know of? I know you haven't been in the job that long.
Right. Not that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I introduced you as Ranger Supervisor, and while you don't have the classic Smokey the Bear hat, tell us a little bit about what that job entails. I think the first time you've been on the radio since you got the job.
It is the first time I'm on the air with the job. Mm-hmm. So basically, I have a team of, there's five of us. We have three of us are full-time. We have two part-timers. We really spend our day getting out, talking to the public, educating on trails at our parks, helping out where we can. We have programs going on, you know, while school is in session, our rangers, we're putting on programs in the schools, what the rangers do. We had a really cool compass program where elementary kids got to learn how to use a compass and run through some skills and, you know, learn how to get through this area with their compass.
Okay, so your staff does education, obviously.
Yes.
You're responsible for about how many miles of trails?
So in all, we're just shy of 200. I think it's around 180 miles of trails, both commuter and single tracks out in the mountains.
So during the summer, I take it you got your rangers are out every day sort of checking on what's going on in the trails?
Yes.
And what kind of maintenance do you have to do in the summer on those trails?
Well, the maintenance side, our trails team is really good about, mm-hmm. you know, the maintenance on that. They hear about issues. They get out there right away to take care of fallen trees, any other issues. We had that wind event a few weeks back. Mm-hmm. They were out there working really hard to get those trees cleared from the trails.
And what does your ranger squad do in the winter?
Same things. Right. We're out on trails. We have the cross-country trails. Wintertime, we're actually a little busier. You know, mm-hmm. we spend a lot of time up in Summit Park. with the folks trying to park, you know, going into the backcountry, trying to get the, trying to
maintain the peace.
Well, not necessarily maintain the peace, but you know, we get some parking issues up there.
That's what I mean.
There's a bit of a conflict with the users back there in some of the neighborhoods,
and
so try to soften that a bit.
And Aaron, let's tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, your history before you came to this job.
Sure. I almost 20 years of public service. I was a police officer for 10 of those years. I was a paramedic 10 years prior to that. The majority of that time was spent in Hawaii. I was a police officer on the island of Maui.
You seem like someone who's very skilled at choosing the best places to live.
We've done a pretty good job at that.
Okay, so you've been in law enforcement, you've been in the paramedic field. How is this job different?
Quite a bit, you know, in so many good ways. Obviously, we're not enforcement. Our ranger team is not law enforcement. We get out, we educate. You know, we can when we need to. There's enforcement on the parking issues. But it's more education. It's all about serving the community, getting out there, being stewards for the land. It's really nice change of pace.
What is your favorite part of the job?
Just getting out and meeting people.
You get to go outside all day?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I get stuck in the office quite a bit. But yeah. My favorite part is really getting out on trail, whether it be on foot or on bike, and meeting people in the public.
What changes do you see that you want to bring to the organization since you've come into this job as ranger?
So we've implemented a few changes already on the ranger side or the ranger team. You know, prior to my arrival, my position was new when I came into it. So it was kind of, I've got to kind of create the direction of the ranger team. You know, definitely focusing more on education, talking with kids, getting out there with the public. We have some cool projects coming up that we're going to be working on, one of which is a interpretive trailer that we're going to bring into town. We're actually going to be purchasing the trailer soon. And then we have a designer that's going to build it out. It will be a walkthrough educational experience that you get to walk through, learn what Basin provides, all the things that we do, whether it be our trails, our open space, our rec team, the field house, all the things that Basin offers.
Mm-hmm.
We really want to highlight that in the trailer. And we'll be able to bring that out to community events. We want it, Sunday Silly Market would be a great place to bring it out, have it out at trailheads, bring it to schools.
Now, you anticipate my next question, which is, do you have any interesting projects on the horizon or things that you hope to do? And that's obviously one. Are there any others?
That's a big one.
It is a big one.
We have some smaller things going on. Currently, you know, we have our trailhead cameras, one of the small projects right now. One of the cameras there in Summit Park, we've been having an issue with the solar panels. So contractors are actually right now, they're actually hardwiring it. So during the winter, it doesn't go out of service.
You know, and sort of the related question is, what are you finding to be the biggest challenges that you're what are you having to wrestle with? Because there's always something. No job lacks its challenges.
For me, it's you know, more of a personal shift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my background was more public safety. That was pretty straightforward. Now, you know, getting into the nuances of the community, especially this community, has been the challenge for me, but I've really enjoyed it. You know, I really like the people here. It's a great community to work in, and you know, I have enjoyed that challenge and change.
Aaron, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I think we covered it.
Okay, Aaron Williams, ranger for Basin Rec. Basin Rec this summer. Basin Rec is a KPCW financial supporter. The Park City Council approved a request from Park City Film to expand its number of screenings at the Jim Sani Auditorium. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
Park City Film plans to add 70 additional film screenings per year at the Park City Library. That brings the total number of annual screenings up from 130 to 200. The Park City Council approved the nonprofit's request at its meeting July 10th. Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang said the move is driven by the departure of the Sundance Film Festival. After calling Utah home for more than 40 years, Sundance officials announced earlier this year that its annual film festival will be moving to Boulder, Colorado, starting in 2027.
We feel it's important for us to prepare for that departure now, and to start amplifying our programming, expanding our partnerships, you know, really ramping up what we do, and also to have visibility on the future so we can plan for things like next summer.
The lease amendment also extends Park City Films' season to cover all 12 months. Wang said the nonprofit has been limited to one screening each in July and August under previous lease terms. Park City Film is the only operating movie theater in Park City limits. Holiday Village Cinemas, which is still used for Sundance screenings, shut down in March 2024 as its owner filed for bankruptcy. Park City Film's lease with Park City Municipal is set to expire in June 2027, and both parties intend to begin work on an extension next year. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council held a regular meeting last night. Apparently went a little bit late. We're really lucky that Bill Scirocco is here with the debrief this morning. Morning, Bill.
Morning, Roger. It went quite a bit late. We were in there till 10:30 last night, but I'm happy to be here on this beautiful, beautiful Friday morning in Park City.
It is a beautiful Friday morning. Let's start with an update on the Senior Center project. What's going on there?
So we had a brief update last night where we had put out an RSOQ, which is a request for qualifications for design, really for a design firm. We are in the final phases of that. I think we have four finalists and staff, and the committee is going to choose a winner out of that group, which will allow us to strike an agreement and move forward with, you know, some actual design on the Senior Center. And, I want to thank Craig Weekly, who came in on behalf of the Senior Center last night and spoke, because there has been a little bit of murmur of conversation around town about, you know, where we're moving forward with the Senior Center, and maybe we should move it to a different site. And what Craig said is that, the seniors are supportive of the direction the city's going right now, and it feels like we're moving at a speed that we haven't seen in years. So I'm hopeful that we can, I'm going to push as hard as I can that we get a shovel in the ground by next fall.
And remind our listeners where the site's going to be and what the scope of the new Senior Center will look like.
Yeah, so the site that we sort of transitioned into is the Mawinney site, which is directly across from the library on Park Avenue. Some of you will know it because there's a bus stop right there. Some of you know it because it's just on the other side of where the skate park is. There has been some concern, you're putting the Senior Center next to the skate park. My answer to that is, where are kids from August 18th to June 10th, Monday through Friday from 7:30 a.m. to 3 p.m.? They're at school. Seniors do lunches from noon to 2 p.m. 3 days a week. We're hoping that the county steps up and gets them a little more funding for their programming, and they can go to a fourth lunch per week. But it feels like most of that conflict's mitigated.
I don't know. It sounds like you're stereotyping the notion that the seniors aren't going to use the skate park.
No, I think that was part of the plan was to incentivize a little more youthful behavior.
All kidding aside, that space is now often used for parking for the library, for events, overflow parking for the library and for events. Is there a concern about the loss of those parking spaces?
Yeah, sure. There's always a concern, right? But if you were to go back and listen to the meeting where we had that conversation, the point that I made is we need to think about investments in parking and particularly investments in parking below grade as investments in open space. If we create the ability for us to park below grade, we create the ability for us to have more space at grade for landscaping, for natural environment, for those sorts of things. Now, to start out, we're going to see, what sort of at-grade parking we can fit around the senior site. We're going to find, over at the Memorial lot, we're going to have the designers site the building in the most perfect spot on that lot that allows for the best circulation around the building and for a reasonable amount of at-grade parking. And then we're also going to push to put parking below grade.
I was going to ask if it's feasible to do some below grade parking there.
Look, it is. There are some concerns about water table. When they did survey the lot, for that, they surveyed it in April. You can imagine that the water table is probably at a different level in April than it might be in August, September, October, right? As the seasons dry out, the water table shifts, right? And what I would say is, like, look, all around the country in metropolitan areas along the coast, they build buildings that go down 40, 50, 70 feet below grade along the waterfront. There's a way to build. It might be a little bit more costly, but we're going to look at all the options. We're going to look across the street at the library parking lot. Maybe we need to do something under there. instead if it's a little bit more feasible. We're going to make the best decision, be good stewards of the city's resources, and create the best scenario possible.
And, of course, another advantage of the site is the fact there are bus stops right there for the seniors to use.
Yeah, it's, you know, for it's... A, it's right across from the library, which is a facility that many of the seniors use, right? So it's more convenient to that. B, it's right on the bus stop on Park Avenue. C, it's closer to Old Town, and many of the seniors will walk into Old Town before or after their senior lunches. And then it's also, it's essentially in City Park. So we're very close to Miners Hospital, which is another city resource. You're about 900 feet away from the new community building that's going to be built in City Park. I think we can make a really nice campus if we include the senior center over there.
Now, what's going to happen? Remind our listeners what's going to happen to the old senior center campus.
So that's what we call the Woodside lot.
Yes.
There is some desire to think about some housing on that lot. What that looks like, you know, I don't know. We're going to continue forward with that process separate. We've detached that completely from the effort to build the senior center because that was holding us back.
Right.
And I think it's important to get the senior center done as quickly as possible so that our seniors can enjoy it.
So, but that is city property.
Correct. That is city property.
Okay.
And look, there, you know, the housing is one use. I mean, maybe there's some other community use we can incorporate into that. Be awesome to have a community clubhouse on that property that's a ski clubhouse because it's right across the street.
That's interesting.
From the Empire lot, you know, so a place where if you're local, you can rent a locker cheaply from the city and keep your stuff and be right across from the base of Park City Mountain.
And you suggested that you guys are hoping to get, you know, stuff moving on this pretty quickly. What realistically do you think, when do we realistically do you think we can, same question I ask you so many times, when realistically will we see a shovel in the ground?
You know, tough question. I'm not a planning professional, so I'm going to spitball a little bit here.
Please.
Based on other things that we've done, so if I look at the timeline on the community center, which we just finalized that contract agreement last night, so we're going to roll forward on that pretty quickly. I think there's a chance we could break ground by next fall. And by next fall, I mean fall of 26.
Fall 26, yeah.
We still have to do some zoning and planning work and get approvals and all that stuff. But, you know, 15 months from now should not, I think that's doable.
And you've set up a natural transition to the next topic, which I guess should be the community center.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So last night was the final item on the community center. It was just a revision to the final budget. You know, costs, as everyone knows, costs to do anything have increased and escalated dramatically over the past several years. And city projects are, you know, don't escape that, you know, no matter how well we try to plan. So we finalized the final contract amount on the city community building in City Park. And look, I don't know when the groundbreaking on that's going to be, but I imagine we're using it this summer for camp. And then we probably might get started sometime shortly after that.
Okay, so again, for listeners who can't visualize it, I'm looking at Miners Hospital.
Yep.
Okay, and I go to the left, and there's a playground, and there's a small building that the camp uses, right?
Yep.
And is that where this is going to go?
Yeah, so it's the south end of, call it City Field,
mm-hmm.
and it's that red brick building that has two beach volleyball courts and a basketball court next to it,
mm-hmm.
and some other playground apparatus. That's the location where the new community building will be.
And what will the new community building eat some of the volleyball courts or the playgrounds, or just move them a little bit? I mean, obviously, there's a big field right there.
Yeah, so the existing courts will be occupied by the construction, but when we're all done, we're going to have those back in place. Maybe not in an exact footprint, but so we have to rearrange the site plan a little bit, but we're going to have those elements still incorporated.
And what will this building be used for? What is the demand that the city saw what made them want to do this?
So for me, you know, what I've heard through this process, that the biggest demand is an increased need for, you know, child camp opportunity in the summertime, right? A lot of your child care providers, right? They're not operating, maybe they're not operating, or at least for like the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds,
school's
out,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're not operating in the summertime. So, you know, parents who work need some place for their kids to be during the daytime in the summer, and the city has a great camp operation out of there, and we're looking to expand on that.
Okay. And again, that is going to start this fall.
That is what I understand.
Okay. Speaking of shovels in the ground, let's talk about Bonanza, the 5-acre site. That process is moving forward, as I understand it. Did you make a move on the next stage and then in the contract with the Bryn Shore Development Group?
Yeah, so we've been negotiating it's called an ENA, E as in Edward, N as in Nancy, A as in Apple, exclusive negotiating agreement. We had some final details that we were working on. Looks like we're good to go on that now with Brenshore. And what that means is we will actually start the design process. I know there's some notion in the community that what they saw in the RFP process was design. It was not. Those drawings that you saw on KPCW's website, in the Park Record, those are just placeholders. The design process is going to start as soon as we ink this exclusive negotiating agreement. The city is actually leaning into some professionals to help us with some sort of the way we view the placemaking on the site and the things we want to, you know, how we want to interpret all of the work that we've done already into a built environment. So if you have a notion of you think what you know we're going to build there, you don't. The visuals that you saw do not represent what's going to end up taking place there.
Well, but let's try to understand just a little bit about the economics.
Yep.
The city owns the land.
Yep.
As I believe I saw in the notes that the committee's financial commitment is $30 million.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, we have dirt that the city owns. You've got a developer that's coming in. The city's going to put up $30 million. Who owns what at the end of the movie?
So we will, I believe the intent is to offer a long-term ground lease to Brenshore at a subsidized level. It's, I think we're talking $1 a year. That will allow them to then finance a vertical development on that property, of which the city will participate on the, you know, we have signaled that we would be willing to invest $30 million into that project to help make it pencil, right? Because your cost to build is going to be X, your rental revenue is going to be Y, and if Y doesn't cover X, you need to fill in that gap, right? So that's what the city will do with their investment, and there'll be some financial structure that'll be detailed as we get further along in the process that, you know, shows the city where we stand in the sort of the claim on the assets.
And the goal obviously is to produce a combination of things there. We're going to have some affordable housing, some retail, some restaurants. Let's talk about the notion about the affordable housing. Is the city now committed to the notion that this affordable housing project will be... We've talked before about rental versus ownership concepts in affordable housing.
Yep.
This is going to be all rental, isn't it?
Yeah,
or is that done?
This will all be rental. You know, the difficulty we've had with ownership, right, is in order to keep it affordable, you need to put a deed restriction in terms of capital appreciation. What we've done in the past is we've limited to 3% appreciation yearly. Now, two things happen, and they're two different things. The first thing that happens is if you have to take a mortgage on that property, like if you go to get a mortgage now and your mortgage is 7%, you're paying 7% to own a property that's only appreciating at 3%. So you're actually losing money every year. So that's not a good economic, you know, calculation. The other issue is, even though we put the 3% appreciation cap on it, we had a cottage over at Snow Creek that was a city development that were sold. One of them came back to us 10 years later, and our housing team, God bless their heart, said, hey, we need, you know, this Snow Creek Cottage is available. The city should buy it back, but then we should sell it again for $100,000 less than what only the 3% cap is, right? So they wanted us to re-subsidize because even at 3% a year, that cottage became unaffordable, you know, considering where AMI was currently today, right? So it's ownership is very, very difficult to solve. There's a lot of You send a lot of, you know, not great economic incentives. Yeah. So rental really seems a lot more frictionless. And it's a good way for people to, you know, to buy some time until they can figure out, you know, what they might be able to do long term.
And, of course, then there's the problem that I know that's come up recently with respect to HOA costs.
Yeah.
The ongoing development costs can also create a problem.
Yeah, I mean,
maintenance costs, yeah.
Yeah, look, you know, we had the winter of 22-23, right? You know, 900 inches of snow on the mountain. You know, everybody's snow removal budgets for that season, you know, were two or three times what they expected. And two or three times is, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars more. And those are hard expenses for an HOA and an affordable development to eat up.
Now, you said a few minutes ago that if you think you know what's going on there, you probably don't, which I think is a very pithy way of putting it. Having said that, we got 5 acres. You got so much stuff you have to put in such a small box. if you're going to put, how many affordable housing units is the target?
You know, so in the RFP, mm-hmm. We specifically said up to 20% of the housing can be market rate.
Okay.
So if we just want to start there as a baseline, 80-20, which, you know, as we get into the economics, that might end up being too hard to do. That might cost too much. Yeah. Like we don't know exactly how much the $30 million is going to get us right now.
It's almost the fixed X.
Correct.
Okay, so we've got a fixed X of 30. We have, and what you're saying is, if you can't pencil it at 80-20, you might have to move that. But how many units is the target?
You know, I think the RFP that Brinshore provided, I think they came in around 160 units maybe 170.
Close enough.
So there'll be some, like, you know, we need to look at, obviously, you know, the buildings that they depicted in their RFP were just, you know, basically it's a volumetric study.
They were Lego boxes.
Yeah, they're just showing what the volume you need to accommodate the uses that you're asking for. And it looks like we might have to tweak that, right? Yeah. We want to make sure that whatever gets built there is architecturally significant and really, you know, really is a point of pride for the community.
And I think that's going to be a challenge. So
it will be a challenge, yeah.
And then, so this process, they start the design process. Obviously, there's going to be iterative discussions with the city over the next X months. Again, ambitious target for this one. Do we think we'll see something moving 18 months from now?
This one is a little bit harder to handicap because the model that Brinshore brought to the table relies on maxing out LIHTC financing, both the slightly less competitive. It was usually termed not competitive 4% LIHTC financing versus the highly competitive 9% LIHTC financing.
Stop. LIHTC?
Yes.
How do you spell? What is that?
Yeah, LIHTC, L-I-H-T-C, the Low Income Housing Tax Credit, right?
Yeah.
9% LIHTC will fund about 70% of your construction cost, 4% only about 30%, which is why historically 4% was easier to get. Sure. But there's such a demand for affordable housing now that even the 4% is now becoming much scarcer and harder to get.
So that's a competitive thing to get those loans.
Correct, and they can apply, and they may not get it. You know, Mountainlands Community Housing Trust is trying to redevelop the Holiday Village and Parkside Apartments, and they've applied twice, 2 years now, for the 9% LIHTC, and they haven't gotten it. So they're in year three, and we're hopeful they get it. Knock on wood, they get it this year.
Okay. Anything else we should touch on with respect to Bonanza Park?
No, I just want to reiterate, like, we are just beginning the design process. So we will keep the public, you know, greatly informed as we move along. And council has heard all the feedback, and we are with you. We want to make sure we would do something magical over there.
Okay. Another item that came up last night, and we played a story on the film series, which was they got their contract extended, so they now will have, 200 nights of screenings
Correct.
This year? Okay. We played that story. I wanted to ask you, though, about the discussion about the road project associated with the Clark Ranch housing.
Sure.
Housing. Tell us what happened last night.
So there was an item on the agenda last night asking us to approve an expenditure of $725,000 to begin the engineering work for a frontage road to be built to support the proposed Clark Ranch affordable housing project just to the south of Park City Heights up on that beautiful hillside up there. That original engineering work, you know, was expected to be $150,000-$200,000. The number has grown, you know, pretty significantly. Part of that is because our team, our staff at City Hall is working hard to try to mitigate and take any concerns into account, for the folks at Park City Heights. And then part of that is just to the sheer complication of building that frontage road. It's it gave some of the councilors some pause. You know, I'll point people back to the 2023 feasibility study for Clark Ranch, which cited in there that the projected cost for infrastructure and roads in the project were going to be about $8.6 million. And that the money needed to build the frontage road improvement was going to be $1.3 million. We've got a recent cost estimate on that frontage road, and that frontage road now is estimated to be between $4 and $5 million. For the frontage road. That's just for a mile-long frontage road to access. That's before we even get on the property to be able to put a shovel in the ground to build anything.
Okay, so help our, and this is so much fun with radio. Help our listeners visualize where that frontage road would run from to.
Yeah, so I think the best way is if you're on Highway 40 and you're heading towards Heber, as you pass over 248, you begin to see the Park City Heights neighborhood on your right-hand side. Between Highway 40 and Park City Heights neighborhood, you'll see a dirt road. Mm-hmm. It's built up on a berm, and it goes. It's actually an emergency fire access road to serve the back of the far reaches of the lower Deer Valley neighborhoods. Rising Star Lane, I think, is one of them that has a cul-de-sac with a fire road down to there, and that was put in just as for code and emergency access. Now the city is contemplating, building out that road, extending it a mile from Richardson Flat Road to the south along Highway 40. That would allow us to get to a point on the Clark Ranch parcel where we could actually access the property, because the hillside, it's a pretty steep, rugged hillside, so it's a little bit tricky to get onto there.
And that rugged hillside is where, I understand, is the site that is being contemplated for the Clark Ranch residential development.
Yeah. Yeah, there was it's been referred to as a study that was done in the 2010s, maybe 2017, where there was a committee, and we don't know the exact scope. We don't know the exact direction that the committee was given on in terms of looking at the Clark Ranch property. Clark Ranch property is 340 acres. It's roughly evenly split by Highway 40, so half of it lies to the west on the hillside, half of it lies to the east, and it's that flat kind of sagebrush scrub area. And we don't know how robust that conversation was. We don't know if there was a real good look taken at the east side, which is flat, like we said. We don't have direct access to it off of Richardson Flat Road. It's 500 feet south through some private property, but we already use that private property for access to the Sparky's trailhead, so anyone that goes out there to e-mountain bike on those trails, that's where you park. And the Clark Ranch property is just on the other side of the fence line as you enter that trail network.
Now, is there an ongoing conversation about potentially looking at that east side parcel for some affordable housing development, or is the city now committed to doing it on the west side?
Well, look, the commitment has been to do it on the west side, but I like to approach these situations unconstrained. We've got 340 acres. We can use 10 acres of the 340 acres. The way I would approach that situation is, what is the best spot to use 10 acres to build, the most efficient form of affordable housing, right? Because it's meant to be affordable. So we need to try to minimize the cost of construction. When you get into a more complicated building environment, your costs begin to escalate, and sometimes they escalate, dramatically. So I don't want to be in a situation where we've done all this work and we spent $1 million or $2 million on pre-engineering, and then we find out that it's uneconomical, and then they say, we're told, you can't go back now, we're too far, you have to go forward, and we end up making a bad decision, and it hurts our credibility in terms of executing workforce housing, over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
And I assume one potential advantage of a West Side development would be the access to Richardson Flat. Last week at Council, I understand you guys started talking about a couple of aerial alternatives, one of which would be at the Brew Pub lot, and one of which would be here at Chatham Bridge, I guess, and then another one would be over at Richardson Flat.
Yeah, at the meeting 2 weeks ago, the Council did give direction on on the next step of our pursuit of aerial. We did prioritize a connection from Richardson Flat over into Snow Park, and the reason for that is we have a park and ride in Richardson Flat. There's some hope that will actually be the eventual site of the permanent park and ride, like a fully developed park and ride that has greater capacity than what it has right now. And if we have that, if we had an aerial connection in from Richardson Flat into the snow park, we can make that trip in 6 to 10 minutes, depending on what sort of aerial installation we used.
And I wanted to spend a couple minutes just on that, because that was brought up at the meeting, but I don't know that our listeners have had access to the different, a couple minutes on the different aerial technologies that might be possible.
So the first one that everyone is familiar with, if you think of the Quicksilver gondola over at Park City, it's a single cable ropeway that's your traditional gondola. It's a detachable cabin, you know, so when it gets down to the station, it detaches off the rope, it gets on a conveyor belt and moves around slowly so people can unload and load. And then when it's loaded, the doors close, and then it reattaches to the cable, and then it moves at the speed of the cable. Single cable ropeways typically travel at up to 13 miles an hour. It just depends on what the operating standards are for that lift. A tri-cable gondola, which can accommodate larger cabins, right? It also can accommodate faster speed, right? Because you have two. There's three cables in total, tri-cable. The two outside cables are fixed. The cabin has rollers on the part of the cabin that attaches to the ropeway. There are rollers, and those rollers run on those two fixed cables. The middle cable is what provides the pull. So the detachable element on the cabin attaches to that middle rope. It's being pulled by the middle cable. That provides the propulsion. And then the rollers provide additional support and stability so that can actually run at a faster speed, right? Because more of the weight's being dispersed over three cables. And you can run a larger cabin, right? Because you have three ropes now holding the cabin up. And it can operate in a more windy environment. I think they're rated to operate in up to 62 mile an hour winds, whereas a single cable ropeway can operate at up to maybe a 30 mile an hour wind.
Okay, and what's the rough order of magnitude cost difference between the two?
It depends.
Per foot, right?
Yeah, exactly. There is some account, like there's a lot of expense into your stations, your beginning and your end points, right? There's a lot of concrete, a lot of engineering that goes into that. So you do get some economies as you increase the length to a certain point. A single ropeway is less expensive. I'm going to say, probably if you were looking at a 2 mile installation, it's probably a tri-cable would be 2 to 2.5 times more expensive than a single ropeway. Now, the benefits of the tri-cable, though, is you get greater speed, so you have a greater carrying capacity, and you get greater operating reliability.
And I guess your third point would be, because you can have a larger cabin, you get a lower cost per passenger.
Correct, and so the cabins are very expensive. I mean, the 24 or 26 person cabins on a tri-cable are probably over $500,000 a piece, right? So you can achieve a certain level of carrying capacity with a certain number of cabins, and that might be well below the total capacity of the ropeway. So it gives you future expandability. So if we were to build something like a tri-cable now, we could gear it to carry 2,500 passengers an hour. And then in 2034, when the Olympics come, we could get some help to put, to double the amount of cabins on that rope and increase the capacity from 2,500 people an hour to 5,000 people an hour.
I'm sitting trying to visualize how you would have more cabins on the same cable.
It's just a spacing.
It's just a spacing issue?
Yeah,
okay.
Just a spacing.
Okay. Where do things go from here? Obviously, what's going to happen next is a feasibility study. Is there a feasibility study of looking at the two sites?
Yeah, so staff is hard at work. There are some other important constituents in the conversation, Deer Valley being one of them, right?
Major. Yeah.
There are some private landowners that we need to get on board, and so we need to make sure that the alignment's clear. And the alignment that we've looked at is relatively clear. I think there's only maybe five properties that are private. That the alignment passes over, whereas some of these routings from the Main Street area, pass over, 15, 20, 30 homes.
Well, that's interesting. So the Brewpub lot has more complications in terms of private property.
I'm not necessarily the Brewpub lot. The Brewpub lot may be the least impacted coming from the Main Street area. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is that the best location, though, right? Yeah. So you have to balance the two, right?
Yeah. Okay. Bill, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, I think that's it for today. I just want to encourage everybody to get outside, get on a bike, get up on the mountain, do some hiking. I mean, let's enjoy this little bit of air conditioning that nature's provided.
Yeah, because according to Cedric, it's going to get hot. Thanks, Bill.
Yep, thank you, Roger.
This beautiful weather certainly calls for an evening outside. And maybe a way to spend that evening is at the Concerts on the Slope series, which kicks off tonight in the canyons. On the phone to talk about it is Executive Director and Minister of Fun, Amber Conley. Morning, Amber.
Hey, Roger.
So, Amber, tonight is the first night of
Actually, it's tomorrow night.
Oh, I'm
tomorrow
sorry.
Night.
Thank you.
That's okay. Saturday night, July the 12th, kicks off at 7 o'clock. We have String FX, which is a local electronic strings group. And then we are joined by Carolyn Campbell, which is an internationally renowned violinist with award-winning pianist William Campbell. And they're friends with Casey Elliott of Gentry, so we have a vocalist coming in as well.
Okay, and that is tomorrow night. For those people who haven't checked out this venue, can you tell us a little bit about the venue for Concerts on the Slopes?
Absolutely. So it's a partnership between Park City Mountain and Canyon Village Management Association, and they have put together a semi-permanent stage that sits in between, if you're familiar with the canyons, the Orange Bubble and the Gondola. It is an absolutely beautiful venue, and this year they have put significant amounts of renovations into the slope. If you were one of our dedicated concert goers last year, you remember how steep the slope was. And this, it is not true anymore. So we have a beautiful, pretty flat place to bring your picnics, throw out your blankets. We also have, of course, reserved seating that you can purchase for a little bit more, but it really is family friendly. The one thing I want to tell you about the venue is that we can access the normal Park City Mountain Canyons Village lots. However, they are under construction at the Cabriolet for future years. We're going to have some great parking. So we're really pushing the public transit, rideshare, carpooling, and all of the maps and all of the information is on our website at concertsontheslopes.com and under parking.
So now,
it's okay. Last Saturday, there was an event up at the canyon. So my family and I went to Ecker Hill Park and Ride. We downloaded the High Valley Transit app. We jumped on the 4:30 bus, and we were at the top of the venue at the stage in 24 minutes.
And is there's the one lot that's up there that during the ski season is used for carpools. Will that be available for carpool use?
It is. Okay. So there's a tiny little lot next to the Cabriolet. The lot that probably has the most parking is lot 4, which is the dirt lot behind the Pendry.
Right.
And is that carpool only this summer, or is it first come, first served?
It's first come, first served, but again, we're really asking everyone to be mindful of the parking and carpool rideshare. We do have a rideshare location, which is right behind the 7-Eleven at the bottom of the transit center for Canyons Village.
Okay, so that's this weekend. I know you have a few more things up your sleeve this summer. Let's run through the schedule.
Right, so next Friday night is Mike Posner and DJ Brody Jenner. So you have more of a younger hip pop star coming out. And of course, Brody Jenner is part of the Kardashian crew, so he has a great following. Following that, the next weekend, we have a two headliners. So we have on July the 25th, 80s Night Out, A Flock of Seagulls, Naked Eyes, and Men Without Hats. So if you're into the 80s British kind of punk fun music, that's the one to come to. And then we're going to totally change it up the very next night with Chris Bode, who's a Grammy Award winner, trumpeter, jazz trumpeter.
Okay, that's
Following that, August 1st, we have Plain White Tees, which is, Delilah, they're definitely the younger pop crowd, but a great entertainer. Then we have August 7th, 8th, and 9th, Country Weekend. So it is and I'm going to tell you, if you want tickets, you need to get them now because it's going to be sold out. August 7th is Diamond Rio. August 8th is Lucas Nelson, who's Willie Nelson's son, with Molly Tuttle, who just was one of the winners for the Blues this year. And then following that is Randy Houser. We then wrap up the rest of August. August 23rd, Chris Jansen, Buy Me a Boat. We love Chris Jansen. Get your tickets. And that night we have tickets for first responders, teachers, and we're doing some fun stuff for that one. So we have one more surprise for that one. August 28th is Gin Blossom, Spin Doctors, and Blues Travelers. That one will sell out. If you're Reserved is already gone. We're already at 2,500 tickets. So if you're considering, grab your lawn tickets now. And then we end the season with, award-winning 22 CMA Award, Clint Black, August 30th over Labor Day.
So, Amber, that's a lot more country music than you guys have done traditionally. That's an interesting shift for you.
You know, what we have found is, first of all, we have a strong country audience here in Utah. We also know that a lot of our younger crowds have gotten into the line dancing,
mm-hmm.
and we are selling. There are top selling shows, of course, besides Blues Travelers, Jim Blossom, Spin Doctors, and the 80s. Okay. So they sell really well.
Okay, Amber Connolly, Minister of Fun. I think we all expect to see you line dancing during those country shows at the front of the venue. Thanks for spending time with us.
Of course. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up on Monday, we're going to do the first up. Before I forget, Park City Municipal is a KPCW financial supporter that in connection with the Sirocco interview. Anyway, coming up on Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to do the first of a two-part series about the impact of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill on Medicaid. We're going to be speaking with an economist, Dr. Sherry Gleed from NYU, her analysis of who will be affected by the changes to the Medicaid regulations. And then the following week, we'll be speaking with Kevin Corinth. He's from the American Enterprise Institute. He's got a very different take on the economics and what will happen as a result of the changes to the Medicaid program. That's this week on Mountain Money.